Well, first up on today's show, Bill Resnick is going to be talking with Jeremy Brecker about the proposal made by newly elected Congressperson Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for a Green New Deal that would really be adequate to the enormous challenge posed by climate change. Bill.
Hi, Jeremy Brecker. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi. Good to be with you again.
Jeremy Brecker founded, with others, the Labor Network for Sustainability. He's an activist, a writer, makes documentary films, too, written over 10 really valuable books. His early book, Strike, was described as the single most important book about the history of the American labor movement published in our time. It sure was important for me. His books on the environment and climate change include Save the Humans, Common Preservation in Action, and also a book, Climate Insurgency. In 2009, he wrote a piece, Green Jobs and a Global Green New Deal. This year, almost 10 years later, the Green New Deal reached the U.S. Congress when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, now known as AOC, not all of us get known by our capital letters, and 17 other Democratic members of the new Democratic-controlled House proposed, and I quote, the establishment of a select committee for a Green New Deal. Jeremy Brecker and I will be talking about the Green New Deal and whether any Green New Deal legislation and appropriations could get through the current Congress, and I think something meaningful can happen. Some parts even have a chance of implementation at some point, and maybe in some cities. But first, Jeremy Brecker, were you surprised by the surge of interest in a Green New Deal? And how does AOC's proposal and others by this rising sort of radical wing in the Democratic Party, how does it compare to your vision of the Green New Deal?
Am I surprised? I suppose when something suddenly emerges that no one's been talking about in the public arena, hardly even thought of in the political arena, and barely mentioned in the media arena, and then all of a sudden it's out there and it's being talked about and reported on and debated. Of course, you have to be a little surprised. But there's another way in which, to me, it's really something that I've just been waiting for. One can never know the future, certainly, but I've been almost certain that this was going to happen, that it's dictated by the historical situation we're in and the desperate need to address the problem of climate change and the need to do that in a way that recognizes the problems and needs of working people and protects those who might be accidentally hurt by the side effects of climate protection. We need to have a program that will address climate change in its full emergency threat character and at the same time addresses the social consequences and also the social consequences of the era of growing inequality that we live in that has had such a devastating effect on working people in the United States and indeed worldwide. And the conjunction of those forces had meant that something like a Green New Deal to deal with the climate emergency in a socially positive way seemed to me was bound to happen. And I've been waiting for it for at least 10 years, if not longer, and I'm very, very happy that it's here.
It is really amazing. I just read the legislation last night. It makes good reading. It's, though, very complicated. It's not clear which direction it will go in, particularly when it reaches the Congress and the Senate and the Trumpies, if there's going to be log rolling that could, in fact, have a negative effect, is my sense. It's something that we have to think about because, for example, it talks about one of the major goals being the development and construction of a new, smart national grid. Well, that's exactly what the investor-owned utilities need if they want to maintain control of everything. What they're afraid of is local and regional energy supplies that would be stable, where there's storage, it's resilient, stuff you've written about. It's a great document, actually. It touches all the bases. Tell us what you think about a lot of the specifics in there. It seems to me in some ways it's not clear what direction this could move in.
Well, a couple of things regarding that. Let me start by responding to the specific question you raised about the tension between more centralized and more decentralized ways of addressing climate issues and making the transition to 100% climate safe energy, which is at the core of what we need to do. And my personal take on it is this is not really a choice. In World War II, when the American industry mobilized to combat the Nazis and provide the planes and tanks that were needed to do that, we had General Motors and the largest corporate actually being forced by the government to do the things that were needed in terms of war production, and forced, believe it or not, to shut down the production of civilian cars in order to be able to devote that those resources, human and material, to the necessities of wartime mobilization. And at the same time, you had tiny, tiny enterprises, small backyard machine shops and subcontractors and just small-scale producers who also expanded enormously to help meet the demand for war materials. And I think we're in a similar situation here. We don't really have the opportunity to say we like one approach to protecting the climate better than another one, and so we're only going to do that one. We're basically in a situation like wartime mobilization where we have to do everything. So I personally think that we have to have decentralized energy systems in the ways that if people want to put solar collectors on their roofs as hobbyists, and if people in neighborhoods want to create community solar neighborhood-based small-scale facilities, that we have to have the kind of funding and technical support that allows them to do that. But I think we also are going to have utility
installations.
And let me just say one more thing about the grid, which is a national grid can be a centralizing force, as you say, but it also can be the vehicle that makes very decentralized local energy production be viable, because it allows energy to move around from one place to another. So if you put on your rooftop solar and the sun goes out, it rains for a month, you can compensate for that with energy from other places and other technologies. So the grid in itself is not necessarily the enemy of a decentralized system.
No, in fact, it's necessary to some extent. And these grids, though, could be regional, and there would be storage in every region. So, in fact, if a huge storm knocks down these huge pylons on some mountain, or in California, when you get wildfires that are so hot that they melt the wires and destroy everything, that you still have power in a city, at least for the hospitals and to keep medicines refrigerated and food refrigerated to do the basics.
This is really just a footnote to the need for an emergency mobilization. The greatest significance of the proposal for a select committee for a Green New Deal. After all, these are things that have not even really been discussed in the public arena. The details, the devil is always in the details and everything to do with energy and climate policy, but the plan for a select committee that will go in depth to develop a plan, but at the same time that's mandated by this legislation to come up with a plan that is actually on the scale and scope of what we need to protect ourselves from climate devastation, I think it is a huge step forward.
Yeah, it is, although I think we should really be thinking about that in the ways we support it. That is, a left supports it, and within this select committee, a left will at least be able to be heard and be on TV and promote its ideas. It seems to me this is a wonderful possibility. There's a lot to be said for community energy, not that it's going to create 80% or even 50% or maybe even 30% of the meeting power needs, but it can create a culture of conservation and a very different sort of way of looking at public goods in any community. I see it as a way of politicizing a local economy, and after all, it has a lot of local power, and people are really interested in it. and especially local jobs, of course, and local vitality. It seems to me that's one of the arguments for not allowing the big utilities and the big construction companies to take over all of it and all of the money, which is what they would like to do. They're already angling for that. I think that's the argument, at least, for really emphasizing the local, Jeremy. How do you respond to that?
I agree completely with as much possible local and decentralized energy production as we can do. We need to have that, but we need to have the smaller scale energy provision and community-based, and as much as possible, as much to the extent that that can meet the needs, it should be emphasized. And I think you would find most of the people who are supporting this bill in agreement with that.
Yeah, I think so, too.
This bill is very much oriented toward a social justice approach to climate protection, and that involves local democratization and expansion of local control of financing. It's just we shouldn't be shooting down the larger scale provision, because we desperately need that as well. In terms of an overall World War II style mobilization of all the resources of our society in order to make the transformation
right.
We need.
Just a footnote, when I talk about local scale, I'm talking about Texas and California, which is vast regions that would cooperate together. We don't have to do it from all big solar plantations don't have to be in New Mexico or Arizona, and they can be much closer to the point of use, and they can be then governed in the point of use, and cities would have much more of a role. Anyway, we completely agree. These are all details. This is KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Jeremy Brecker. For at least 10 years, he's been writing on and speaking about the Green New Deal as the only means of preserving human life and what we call civilization, not very civilized, indeed quite warlike, it seems to me, nowadays. Jeremy is talking about the Green New Deal. It's really the only option we have for saving that civilization as global heating threatens cataclysm. Jeremy, if it got to Congress, what do you see as going on? There's going to be a huge amount of log rolling. My sense is in the early years, even if it ever got there, and we don't have too much time left, that compromises would be made that would favor corporate power in one way or another. How to work now to make sure that at least the models of what really would work, how do you see that occurring?
Well, I think there are a couple of very important things about the people who have been promoting the Green New Deal and the Select Committee for a Green New Deal. One is that they have been very open to mass direct participation in the campaign. Actually, the way this got started was a youth climate group called the Sunrise Movement occupied Nancy Pelosi's office, demanding that the Democrats develop a policy that rapidly responding to the problems of climate change. And Representative Ocasio-Cortez came into the meeting with her proposed legislation. And in general, she and her allies have been extremely open to the youth climate movement being directly involved right there in the congressional offices promoting what's needed. So there isn't that wall between let the politicians do their thing on the inside and the people are locked out on the outside. They definitely see it as someone put it, their role is to bring the movement into Congress. And the other thing that I think is an important factor here is, again, the same forces have been very involved in a parallel campaign to demand that Democratic politicians, especially people in Congress, refuse to take money from the fossil fuel interests. And they actually passed a resolution through the Democratic National Committee a few months ago banning the acceptance of fossil fuel contributions by Democratic candidates. And then there was a big counter push, which I regret to say was supported by parts of organized labor, to say this was an insult to workers in the fossil fuel industry, and they should, of course, accept contributions from the fossil fuel interests, and the Democratic National Committee reversed its position. But more than 1,000 Democratic candidates in the last midterm elections at various levels took the pledge not to accept fossil fuel contributions. And I think making a issue within the Democratic Party of, are we going to allow ourselves to be dominated by these enemies of humanity or not? Think of it as a little like the politicians and the religious organizations that accepted monies from slaveholders before the Civil War, and the abolitionists made a huge moral issue about, should, for example, religious organizations be accepting funding from slaveholders? And that was one of the ways that they drew the issue of, are you for slavery or are you against it? And this is part of our drawing the issue today about, are you against climate change or, in fact, in practice, are you for it? And it's a way of identifying and isolating the friends of climate change.
This is KBLU Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Jeremy Bricker, who's written a lot of books on social movements and struggle and the way the unexpected often happens, great upsurges that we never expected. Perhaps we're now in a world where those upsurges have become almost inevitable. We have to deal with climate change. Jeremy, one final thing. In your book, Strike, that was what was, I thought, what I recall, at least, in the book Strike. And you have a new edition out, actually.
Well, I'm happy to say there is a new updated edition of Strike with a new section called Mini Revolts of the 21st Century. And it deals with things like Battle of Seattle against the World Trade Organization and the Occupy Wall Street movement, and most recently the teachers' movements in Chicago and elsewhere for the protection and expansion of public education. And we've seen these after a long period in which it seemed as which in which the strike was almost just history. We've seen very extensive return to the use of the strike, but often in very new and innovative ways. We've seen things like the Fight for 15 for low-wage workers, and we've seen things like the strikes by teachers on huge state-by-state basis in West Virginia and other states with extreme attacks on public education and the well-being of teachers, where there's been an amazing fight back using strikes allied with broad community organization to restore and protect and expand public education.
Jeremy, you may have to write another edition of Strike, because I think we may be in this period of upsurge, which is absolutely necessary, and people are beginning to understand that it's going to be as powerful as anyone in the past, it seems to me, because its survival of all of us is at stake in some way, and I think people are beginning to understand that. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Great. Thanks for listening.
Setting on the century, and we are armed to the teeth. We're all working together now to make our lives merge.